anonymity will be shortly out to close. My name is Gene, and I, too, am an alcoholic. And in identifying as an alcoholic, I base that identification on my interpretation of the definition of the word alcoholic, as it's defined in the third chapter of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it says that we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's all it says. Doesn't make any reference to how much you drank, what you drank, where you drank, or what happened as a result of your drinking. Nowhere does it say to qualify as a member of AA or as an alcoholic. You've got to drink wine, spend time in Skid Row, get married 5 or 6 times to the same woman, go to all them institutions and things like that. I, too, owe a debt of thanks to all of you for letting me participate in this lifestyles of the rich and famous up here. This certainly is an enchanting place, and it's very conducive to reminding us how small a part we really are in this world. I want to thank the people who invited me here. First two guys I met was Henry and Wes. I didn't know whether I was at an AA conference or a tattoo parlor. How about Joe C? Did y'all get a look at Joe C this morning with that shirt he's got on? Looks like he should be selling flowers at the airport. Not like any gathering of alcoholics, you know. You meet old friends and you meet new friends, and the true spirit of the fellowship, you know, exudes in places like this. I'm going to say something now that might be a little controversial, but please accept it from my heart. It's just sort of a feeling that I have, maybe not a doctrine that should be followed by those of you who are relatively new to our program, but I make this statement in full truthfulness with myself, that these kind of activities, your shindig, your conference, your get-togethers, or whatever, are an essential part of my recovery, you know. I've often said that, and please understand me when I say this, that if all my sobriety represented today was that 5 or 6 nights a week I was going to some church basement to drink that shitty coffee and eat them lousy cookies and sit around and listen to our bullshit over and over again, that I'd give a hell of a lot of thought to going back to drinking, you know. Because I didn't stop drinking to stop living. I stopped drinking to live. Because that's what Bill promised me in his writing. He said that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program designed for a new way of life. New way of life. And that's exactly what I wanted. I wanted a new way of life. I first came in here with the idea that this was a punishment, that sobriety was a punishment, and that AA was truly a penance. You know, it was though the good father said, well, for all of your past drinking, your penance is 50,000 meetings of AA and 6 months on general service and H&I every Thursday, you know. Oh, Jesus, you know, and that's really the attitude I had until much wiser people than me pointed out that, like you, I had been given another opportunity at life. And that's truly what this is. Traditionally, Sunday morning meetings are referred to as the spiritual meeting. And as many other members of Alcoholics would remind you, all meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual meetings. You just can't... You just don't segregate them in any way. But generally, at least I have always assumed that that's the meeting that perhaps we should bring ourselves back into some semblance of reality. As Clancy pointed out last night, you know, Many of us perhaps are quick to forget, you know, and it's easy to forget. It's easy to forget. We take our sobriety for granted, and many times we just sort of accept this new way of life as though it's been here all the time. Sometimes not realizing how perilous close we are to ending it, or can end it, you know. You know and I know, and I don't like to throw a damper on your party, but I have never been really known as a guy who had too much tact. And I'm not ashamed of the fact that in some areas they refer to me as a guy who tells it how it is, because I love this program, and this is my way of life, and this is my life. And I cherish it, you know, more than anything that I have now or ever will have or ever have had. And sometimes, you know, you feel as though you're an AA cop, you know. You want to protect everything around it, which is certainly not right. But I guess you know, or you should know, and our experience in Alcoholics Anonymous tells us this very tragic fact, and our own personal experiences back it up, that everybody in this room this morning has not finished drinking. But based on our past experiences, as sad as it is and as tragic as it is, there are people in here right now who are not finished. And by reasons known perhaps only to them, and that's probably how it should be, there will again come a time in their life when they'll insanely, you know, reach out for a drink or a needle or a pocket rocket or smoke a funny cigarette or jam a bunch of that shit up their nose or whatever, you know. And the lady over there is looking at me with daggers right now as though I've screwed up the whole weekend, you know. I want you to know something, lady. I didn't originate those words. If you've taken time to read the book, you'll get into the fifth chapter and you'll see where those words are. And if you haven't got a book, I'll quote them for you. It says, "Despite all that we can say, many who are real alcoholics, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, will try to prove themselves the exception to the rule. There will be people in this room who will deny, at some time perhaps in the future, that they're powerless over alcohol." And that's sad, and that's tragic. I don't really want to get into normal drinking and that kind of drinking. You know, it gets a little embarrassing, and I certainly don't say this to appear to be braggadocious or anything like that, but you know, you come here and somebody says to you, "Oh, tell us the talk that you gave in Houston." And then another guy says, "Hey, don't forget, remember what you said at the Cornhusker Roundup, tell him that." And some other jerk says, "Jesus, that talk I heard in Seaside, Oregon, you know." Well, Christ, we'd be here until, you know, next Thursday some goddamn time. Well, no, we wouldn't, because I couldn't remember that stuff. I guess lying is a hard thing for me to remember, and I usually lie. But I was thinking as we were eating breakfast, you know, of the things that seem to be important to my sobriety right now, you know. You look out there and it just overwhelms me, and it's not that unique. I live at the foot of the Sierra Mountains, which are a hell of a lot higher than these, and not that I'm condemning you, in my estimation, probably just as, or maybe more picturesque, but somehow looking down through this valley, you know, it's sort of awesome to me. And as I tried to think, what should I talk about to please the one from Houston or this one or that? I almost gave thought of going into town last night and drinking and getting another story, you know. But I dreaded the thought of coming up that goddamn hill again, you know. Figure if I ever get down that son of a bitch, that's it, you know. But I was reminded, you know, that expanse out there can't help but bring a little bit of spirituality into your life. Now, I am not an overly religious man. I'm not a churchgoer. I'm neither proud or ashamed of that. My spiritual program, my understanding of God, lies directly within the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I don't carry the Bible, but I think my communication with the God of my understanding is probably as real, and if not more genuine, than many of the people who walk into places of worship each Sunday morning with their heads held high and the Bible under their arm and participate in 1 hour of false divinity and then go out and try to screw their best friend's wife that afternoon, you know. And, I believe in you. In this program. And I learned that rather a hard way. And I'd like to share that with you. You know, I came to AA when I was 24 years old. And that's a long, long time ago. And that was a time when 24-year-olds were rather unique in this program. And you got doted on constantly by the older female members with all of their chicken shit crap like, "Oh, you're so lucky to be here at that age, you know. The hell are you trying to tell me I'm lucky to be in AA, you know?" And he said, "Yeah, you're going to miss so much, you know." And I didn't miss anything. I went to the penitentiary. I went to Skid Row. You know, I'd done it all. But I never could accept you then. I couldn't accept perhaps your wisdom. I could accept you as people, but not the wisdom and the strength that you were trying to share with me. And like so many with that negative attitude, I made up my mind to fight you from the word go, you know. I was going to be that one in a million. I was going to be that one guy that, as the book says, who will persist in the illusion that somehow, some way, someday, I'll once more be able to drink like a normal person. And the things that were part of that pursuit, the things that were part of that illusion, you know, totally eventually humiliated me and brought me to a depth of lowness that was, I was so low I often said that I'd have to stand on a box to look a snake in the eye, you know. But it was for no other reason. It wasn't for, I don't believe, any kind of emotional immaturity or lack of education. I think I'm an alcoholic because I like to drink, and I like to drink too much. I don't think it has really anything to do with big, severe problems. I don't recall that many problems as a kid growing up, you know. I can't blame my early life. I was born and raised in New York City in the sort of a ghetto-type atmosphere during the Depression. But I have brothers and sisters whose lives turned out tremendously and morally right and correct, you know, and experienced none of the hideousness that eventually became my story. And I finally, you know, even after I came to AA, stayed drunk for 6 years, in and out, you know, constantly fighting the program. And so finally, as it's wont to be, I was brought mercilessly, you know, right to my knees. And there's a passage somewhere in our literature, and I can't recall what book it is or what, but it mentions the word dilemma. I'm sort of a student of words, you know. I really don't have that much of an education and a formal education. And for maybe the last 20 years or so, I've sort of educated myself. What I do is I generally try to take 2 words a day out of the newspaper. Words that I don't really know what they mean or how to use them or express them. And then I look them up in a lot of dictionaries that I have. And I've read the dictionary, and before you snicker at that, I'll tell you it's probably the most interesting book you'll ever read in your life. And I read it, you know, searching for some kind of knowledge. And after I pick out 2 words, I try to use those 2 words after looking up all the definitions. And then I compare them in a Roget's thesaurus, the different ways I can use them. And then I try to use them as much as I can that day in my daily conversation. And so over the years, I've learned a lot of words, and I enjoy reading words. And some words fascinate me. And the word that I was just going to tell you about really fascinated me is a word called dilemma. You know, dilemma is an exciting word. It sort of says, Jesus, something's going to happen, you know. And that's what I like, you know. And the first place, of course, you see it is in the big book where it says, lack of power was our dilemma. But the part where I recall, it says, a dilemma will generally precede our decision as to whether to continue on in our madness or reach out for recovery. And that was me, you know, the dilemma. When was that dilemma? What is that dilemma? A man once told me that the definition of dilemma means you have the opposite answers for the same question. And both answers are valid. Now, that seems odd, you know, and I thought maybe he was entering the early stages of male menopause or something. But then I recall the times in my life, in my drinking career, and surely you have faced them, too. And the most obvious to me was back at a time when I had relegated myself to that lower environment as a year-and-a-half resident of Chicago Skid Row, living as a... And the only way to describe it is as a mad animal, you know, for a year and a half. And my life was nothing more than when I could sell my blood and when I could drink. And my lifespan depended upon when my next drink was to be gotten. Sometimes my life would only be 20 minutes, you know, from 20 minutes to get one drink that would keep me alive for another 20 minutes. And because I was convinced, as many, you know, that if I didn't have a drink, I'd die. Surely, I'm not the only person in this room who's experienced that. Many of us, you know, at some time in our drinking careers have grasped our heads and said, Jesus Christ, give me a drink before I die. And maybe that's hard for some of you normal drinkers to believe that, but it's the absolute truth that we believe we're going to die. I honestly accept the fact that the last year of my drinking was done more out of fear of dying than any kind of alcoholic reasoning. I was convinced that if I didn't drink, I'd die. And I drank even though I didn't want to drink. But I was just scared to stop. Scared to stop. And just as soon as I'd get a drink, my only thought would be 20 minutes further. Will I get another one about 20 minutes from now, or am I going to die? Or am I going to die? Of a way to live, and it certainly is a clear example of your life being unmanageable. And it was at that time, and I remember that morning very well. I had shuffled into a place called Big Rothschild's, a scummy sort of a hole on West Madison Street, just as filthy a rotten a pigsty as you could find. But that was where it was going to happen to me, you know, and at that stage, there was no longer any communication between you and the bartender, you know. The patterns were the same as soon as you shuffled in and you assembled enough pennies and nickels and dimes that the bartender was convinced you had enough to pay for a drink, and you got a drink. And in those days, it was 15 cents. 15 cents for 4 ounces of some cheap wine. I generally put in a 7-ounce paper cup. And the morning that I experienced that dilemma, I can remember looking at that cup, you know, and full of all of them fears, them guilts, them frustrations, and the shaking and the sweating and every nerve and every muscle in my body about ready to leap out of my skin and convinced I was going to die, but crying and sweating and looking at that friggin' drink, and that's the only way, I'm sorry, that I can describe it. And saying to myself, you dumb son of a bitch, you know, if you drink that, it's going to kill you. And I knew that. If I drink it, it's going to kill me. But yet in the back of my head, something else was saying, but if you don't drink it, you're going to die. And that's the opposite answers for the same question. And they're both right. What the hell am I going to do? If I drink it, it kills me, and if I don't drink it, I die. I have to make a decision. I have to make a decision. And I wisely sought out the advice of a guy on AA. And we started to talk about the one thing I had been lacking. And you know, not that it's a guarantee, but it's right there in the book, and it's as close to a guarantee as you're going to get. The second of the three pertinent facts that are read in that portion of the fifth chapter at just about every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous make a very clear and definite statement. Those of you who maybe didn't hear them as they were read this morning, you know, the second one says that we believe that no human power can relieve our alcoholism. So that eliminated everybody from Bill Wilson right on down. No human power. Well, then, for Christ's sake, who can? And then those same men and women who are just like you and I here today, the men and women who wrote this book, you know, they were no different than us. If we could push the clock back 49 years or so right now, you would be the people who wrote the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's what they look like. And they made this very definite statement in answer to no mortal human being could relieve our alcoholism. They said, but God could, and could is a definite statement. And then they said, and would, and that is a very definite statement. So they told us the answer right there. God could and would. Now they left it up to us, if you want it. If he was sought. If he was sought. So as stupid as I was, it became obvious that I must have to speak this God. But even though it says on my birth certificate I'm a Catholic, educated in the parochial school system, I never understood God. And I'd like to share that with you now. And before I do, I hope I don't sound blasphemous to you. I certainly don't want any of you to think I'm ridiculing any kind of form pottery of anything. I am bound as a moral obligation to you to share with you my experience and honesty, and that's the best I can do. I'm going to tell you about God as I understood him. As a little kid, I used to be ushered into a church called Our Lady of Victory Church in a predominantly Italian neighborhood referred to as Little Italy in New York. And I used to look at the statue. I used to wonder why people could be so dumb to put all of their faith in statues. I just couldn't conceive that a statue could do anything for you. That statues were made of plaster and water and just put together. And you could buy any number of them on the highway between San Diego and Tijuana any Sunday from anywhere from $5 to $50. And yet people swore by them statues. And as a little 7-year-old kid, I'd sit up there in the front row because we had to go to Mass every morning before school, and the nuns sit behind you, cracking you on the head and on your knuckles, you know, put your baseball cards away, sit upright, kneel, crack, bang, stop talking, spit out your gum, bang, bang. And that's about what the hell church meant to me. There was one thing that held my fascination a little bit, though. The Italian women used to come into that church every morning. Italian women have to be the greatest mourners in the world, you know. And I really don't say that to be cute or funny. It just seems when an Italian dies, man, the black comes out all over you. And I used to watch them as I'd be kneeling there in the front out of the corner of my eyes, you know. And they always came into the back of the church, and they went down them sides. Now, I hadn't received my first Holy Communion yet, so I wasn't allowed ever to go down the sides of the church. We always had to come right down the center. So there was a mystique about the sides of the church. And as they'd go down the aisle, they'd be crying and mumbling and rattling them big old beads, and then they'd sort of disappear off into a corner someplace. Although I couldn't see them, I could hear them down there. I wonder, what the hell, you know, do they do down there in the corner? And little did I ever realize how important that was going to be in my later life, you know. But I have a very vivid memory of just about every Italian woman who ever left the church. Because when they'd leave that corner, they always came to the center of the church. They genuflected and turned around and walked out the middle aisle, right past me. And I'd be there like that, you know, looking at them. And you know what I remembered? And I still remember that when they walked out of the church, they always looked better than when they walked in. Something happened in that corner. And I didn't know what the hell it was. Didn't attach too much importance to it at that particular time. Never thought I'd have any reason to. Well, when I approached this man on AA to talk about God, he asked me the obvious question. He said, "Surely God's been in your life. Haven't you ever talked to God?" And I said, "No, I can't really remember any times." And as Clancy pointed out last night, eventually this guy threw a lot of prodding. I said, "Well, I remember one time," I says. "I prayed," I says, "but that was a coincidence. That had nothing to do with it." And you know, whenever you say the word coincidence in front of an old timer, they put that shit-eating smirk on their face. Because they know they got you. They know they got you. And he said, "Tell me about the coincidence." So I told him, and it happened when I was about 7 or 8 years old. My brother Jackie, my older brother, and this is no big deal nowadays since the introduction of antibiotics, but back in the 30s, my brother came down with double pneumonia and streptococcus at the same time, which generally in those times was a very fatal illness, very fatal illness. And because it was during a depression time and our family was very poor, we were on what they called relief, which was the welfare system of our time. There certainly was no money to put my brother in a hospital, and the common mode of treatment in those days, if you didn't have money, is that the county or the city would furnish a hospital bed for you to keep at home, and a city nurse visited 2 or 3 times a week, and then the doctor would come from the county once a week, and that was it. And the care of your family member was done by another family member. Now, I was too young to realize the seriousness of the illness. I didn't put too much attention to it, to tell you the truth. And my brother was in bed, and they kept the bed in the parlor for a long time. And then one night, the doctor was there visiting my mother. And I was listening through the doors, you know, and I heard the doctor tell my mother that my brother was going to die that night. I wish I could be dramatic and say I burst out in tears, you know. But in my immaturity, I don't recall it even phasing me a bit. Knowing my basic character at that time, I probably was only thinking of something selfishly like, would I get his baseball mitt when he dies or something like that. But I was sent off to bed, you know, with that news embedded in my mind that my brother was going to die. And I woke up the next morning and gave no thought to my brother. And mother got me ready for school, and off I went to school at about 7:45, like I had done every morning in my life. And on the way to school, it was customary for little sons of bitches like me to steal the pennies off of the newsstands, you know, in front of the candy stores so I could buy candy. And I did that. I stole 5 or 6 pennies off of a newsstand and went on my way to church, never giving a thought to my brother. And I went in and knelt down, played with my baseball card, fondled my pennies, looked at the Italian women, chewed my gum, got racked by the nuns a couple of times, and then went on to school and went through the day in school, got out at 3:00 and started down the hill and was standing there in the corner waiting for Mr. Schaefer, the cop, to give me the signal to cross the street and go on down the hill and go on home. And as I was standing there on the corner, all of a sudden it hit me, you know. Reality. Your brother's probably dead. And all I could think of was horrible scenes like my brother's face being covered with dirt, and that it was already covered, and that I would never see him again. And I cried, and I cried like a little boy would cry. And I turned around, and I noticed I was in front of the church. That wasn't nothing new. I knew that all my life. But this time it made a difference. And I thought of the Italian women. And I thought of that corner. And I went into the church. Now, only Catholics in this room would understand this decision. I had been told by the nuns and the priests never to go down the side of that church, you know, until after my first communion. Otherwise, I'd grow hair on my hands, and I'd get horns, you know, and all of that. But I was going to go down to that corner, and I could remember looking around to see if there were any nuns or priests present, and there were none in the church, and down the side I went courageously as hell. And I was rather disappointed when I got to the corner because there was nothing there but another bunch of statues. And again, I was disappointed, you know. What the hell are you going to do with statues, I guess is the thought. But I guess I figured as long as I'm here, you know, I should do something. I'd be a liar and a phony if I told you I could remember what I did. That would be over 50 years ago, you know, more than that. But I'm pretty sure I know what I did. I know I must have got down on my knees just out of habit and knelt there at the railing. And I probably prayed, but I didn't pray any of those things that the nuns had drilled into my head, that every kid who ever went to Catholic school knew by heart, that had to recite over and over and over again, you know, that really meant nothing, as some of us sometimes when we close a meeting, we recite the Lord's Prayer, and it just seems to be a race to see how quick we can get it done, you know. That had always been my attitude towards prayer. But that afternoon, I didn't recite anything. I'm positive of that. And it might very well have been the first time in my young life that I communicated with whatever God was. And that was the first time in my life that I didn't talk out of my mouth. I talked out of my heart. I talked about my brother. And I cried. And I asked whatever God was not to let my brother die. My brother Jackie had retired as the treasurer of the Longshoremen's Union in New York City. An honorable retirement that he had for many years. And you'd have to know the union business in the Longshoremen's Union in New York to realize what a task that was. And he was just out here to visit me as he stopped on his way back from Hawaii with his lovely wife. So he's alive. He's alive and has lived an exemplary life. I wouldn't be that egotistical to think for one minute that my brother's alive as a direct result of any kind of communication that I made. I'm quite sure my mother and my father and my aunts and my uncles and a lot of other people prayed a lot more, communicated a lot more with God with a lot more sincerity than I did, and many, many more times. And I told this to this jackass that was talking to me about God. I said, so you see, it was just a coincidence, Ned. And he put that smile on again, you know. And he kept prodding and prodding. And I kept saying, no, that's it. That's the only time. I said, God's sort of given me the shitty end of his stick all my life, you know. That same self-centeredness that us alcoholics display all the time, you know. Let me show you how ridiculous we can get. And please excuse me, I'm going to use a four-letter word, but I have to use it to explain, and I don't mean it in any way of vulgarity. This same guy, Ned Fink was his name, had been 12-stepping me one day as I was sitting in front of the blood bank at Broadway and Wilson, if any of you know where that is in Chicago. A scummy neighborhood. I was hopeless, useless, nobody wanted me. The only thing in my life was to sell blood and drink, and I'm just sitting there like a total wreck. And this Ned is preaching to me, you know, and he said, Duff, all you got to do is turn your life over to the care of God. And I says to him, egotistically, as only an alcoholic could do, I'd say, yeah, but suppose he fucks it up. And that's just how I felt. That's just how I felt. And I know that's not the kind of language that should be present at a meeting like this, but I'm sure you understand that I was expressing a feeling not any kind of vocal language I use. And as he prodded me some more, you know, he said, come on. And I said, no other time. I said, well, there was one time, I said, but that was a coincidence too, Ned. And he said, tell me about the coincidence. And it was at the same school, only it was a few years later now, and it's time to go from the eighth grade into the public school system. And if you know anything about Catholics, they have a very distorted sense of the value of education. Roman Catholics believe that 8 years of elementary parochial education is the equivalent of a doctorate from Southern Methodist University. And on that eventful day in June, when the nuns came marching down the aisle handing out everybody their report cards, they went right past me. And a priest came in and handed me an envelope with a letter in it to take to my father. The letter said something like, it is the opinion of the faculty of Our Lady of Victory School that your son Eugene be held for one more year at the eighth grade level due to his inability to understand our course in English. I got left back. They don't even do that, I guess, anymore in school. But I was to be held for one more year. The terror of knowing I had to face my father with that fact, I knew that all he'd see would be, your son is too dumb to go to a public school. He wouldn't read the letter. And he beat me to within an inch of my life. Oh, I gave thought to wondering what the age limit was for the Foreign Legion. Which would be worse, burning to death or drowning? Is it true that if you dig deep enough, you come to China, you know? All sorts of immature things went through my mind, and I was scared to death. And I emptied out my locker. Mother had given me a nickel to take the trolley car home, and I had taken all of them things out of the locker, the half-finished bookends, and torn gym shorts, and busted loose-leaf binders, and a deflated football, and a torn softball, all of them valuable things that you take home, you know. And I was standing there in the corner waiting for Mr. Schaefer to give me the signal to cross the street so I could go down the hill, catch the trolley, and go home. And all of a sudden, I turned around, and again, I realized I was standing in front of the church. And I remembered the Italian women. I remembered the corner. And I remembered my brother. And I turned around, and I walked into the church. And I put all the stuff down in the vestibule. By this time, I had received my Holy Communion, so I walked boldly down the side. I went to that same corner with them same statues. I paid very little heed to the statues. I went immediately to my knees. And again, I didn't pray. I talked. And I know I talked from my gut and I talked from my heart. And I expressed to a God that I understood, I believe, my fears. And how fearful I was of facing my father. And how ashamed I was of not having been smart enough to get promoted. And like I had done the first time with them five pennies, there was a big brass rack right in front of me with a whole lot of candles in it. Must have been 100 candles. Some of them were lit, some of them weren't. And it said, offering 10 cents. I fondled the five pennies I had in my pocket for candy, and later on I fondled the nickel that my mother had given me for the streetcar. And I figured, what the hell, for a kid, it's probably half price. And I put the nickel in that brass slot, and I lit every candle that wasn't lit. And then I left. And I picked up my stuff in the vestibule, and I went down to the corner, and Mr. Schaefer let me by. I went down the hill, and I told the streetcar conductor that I dropped the nickel down the sewer, and I rolled a few fake tears down, and he let me on. And I don't really remember if this was true, but it seems like it was. There were no other seats on the streetcar except one. There was only one empty, and it was shared already by a huge big guy, great big fella. And I went over and I sat in it with him, two to his feet, but I had all of this crap on my lap, so I sort of sat with my knees out into the aisle and my back to this lad, who was about 24, 25 years old. And as the streetcar trundled along for a few stops, all of a sudden this big guy says to me, "Getting out of school for the summer?" And I said, "Yeah, that's right." And he said, "Boy, I'll bet you you're happy." And that was like pulling the finger out of the dike in the Little Dutch Boy story, you know. Not the one you know. And it all came out. And I started to cry and bawl. And I told the whole thing to this stranger. I told him how scared I was to face my father, how ashamed I was of failing, and how I wasted so much time playing with the baseball cards. And he listened to me. Then he said, "Didn't anybody tell you that the public school system has a summer school program that you can give up 8 weeks of your summer and you can go to summer school and you can take a course in English? And if you pass it, you'll get promoted." I don't know if they were ever going to tell me that or not, but nobody had up till that day. So I listened to him as he told me about it. And I asked him kids questions like, "How could I pass it in 8 weeks when I couldn't do it in 22? And things like that. And he had the answers. He said, "Well, you'd have to pay attention. You'd have to do this." And I began to like him. And I remember saying to him at the end, I said, "Do you really think that I could do that?" And he said, "Well, would you put the baseball cards away?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." And he said, "Well, would you do the lessons at night that they sent home?" And, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And he smiled and he said, "Well, I'm pretty sure you'd pass that." The man that sat alongside of me that day, his name is Hamilton B. Ryder, R-I-D-E-R. About 4 years ago, he retired as the superintendent of schools in Mount Vernon, New York. The day he sat alongside of me on that streetcar, he was a young student teacher, just out of college, and he'd been assigned to teach the English course at the summer school session. So you see, if you're honest enough to look at these coincidences, and you have the courage to face them, you cannot deny the existence of this power, regardless of who you are. And I want to emphasize that, just in case there sits amongst you some who may think you are atheist, or some who may think you're agnostic. I never heard those words till I came to AA to say the honest and goodness truth. All of us, regardless of who the hell you are, believed at one time in your life, and don't tell me you didn't. Have you ever met a 3-year-old atheist? 3-year-olds, I'll tell you something you believed in. We all believed in the Easter rabbit. We all believed in Santa Claus. And you know any kids that walk around saying there are no gods? Like hell, you know. That's just something that's formed by us. Hell, let me tell you, I don't know half of you, hardly any of you in this room. But yet I am cocky enough and gaudy enough to tell you about a time that you talked to God. Maybe you forgot it, but I'll damn well remind you, just in case you're reluctant to seek out this power. Please, how many of you, by a show of your hands, are fathers? Well, just about all of you. Would you dare try to tell me or anybody else here you've never talked to God? Let me tell you about a day or a night that you talked to God. Maybe you've forgotten it. Clear your head right now. Try to recall that day or that time when the greatest thing in your life is about to take place. The most important thing in your life, your wife, has just been taken away to give birth, to create the greatest miracle known to man, to create a child. Your child. You want to know what you were saying? Oh, God. Please, God. I don't care now whether it's a boy or a girl. It really don't make a hell of a lot of difference now.
just make it all right, God. Just don't let nothing happen to them, God. I just two hands and two. That's all. I don't want nothing else, God. And only you know the answer to that. Only you know the answer to that. And how about you, any of us in this room who have participated in the wars of our country? Are you going to tell me you didn't talk to God? You weren't there if you didn't. You weren't there. One of the oldest sayings I can remember in World War II, there are no atheists in foxholes. And how true that is. Every man who ever shouldered a gun said, "Please, God! Don't let me get killed. Please, God." And here you are. Here you are. The presence and the power of God abounds around us. If, as it says in those concepts, if he would sought. You're not going to find it sitting out there doing your income tax or looking at baseball cards. So then as Ned told me about this, I began to be willing. But yet I kept thinking of statues. How phony can I be? I'm not going to go talk to a statue. What does God look like? How do you feel God? And then one day at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I experienced, I guess, what's referred sometimes in the book, but not in this gender, as another moment of clarity. We stood up as we had stood up thousands of other occasions to close the meeting and got ready to say for a thousandth time one of them prayers, Abba. But this time, I said it the same way that I said it as I knelt at that altar in front of them chaps. I said it from in here. And just as soon as I said it, I knew. Our Father, that's it. Our Father. Not that in any way am I trying to present the image of my late father as the image of God to anybody. But as I said those words, I thought of my father. And I loved my father. I loved my father more than I've loved anything in my entire life. My father was the greatest thing in my life. In the eyes of the district attorney of the state of New York, a guy by the name of Tom Dewey, my father was a criminal and paid a horrible price for that. But in the eyes to most of the people he knew, he was more of a Robin Hood than he ever was a criminal, you know. And my father had a zest for living that is unequaled any place I've ever been. God, he lived each moment to the fullest. I can remember how he used to frustrate my mother. My father stood about 6'4", and he was about 240, and every inch of him was a man. He was a tough cookie, I have been told. I never saw him in any other way than in his gentleness. I only saw him through a little boy's eye. And my mother used to say, your father had no concern about money at all. And one of his favorite expressions he'd say to his little wife, Julie, he'd say, Julie, stop fretting about money. All money can do is cause trouble. He said, the secret is to get rid of it as quick as you can. And she'd go mad, you know what he'd do. But that's how he lived. He used to say life should be nothing but a party from the moment it starts to the moment it ends. And nothing should interfere with it. And you know, he lived that. He lived that way. I can remember Sunday morning walking with my father. My father didn't attend church either. His church was the Elks Club. And I never used to see my father that much due to the nature of his activities, except on Sundays. And on Sundays, because I was the baby of the family, I was his prize, he would take me with him. And as I said, I lived in Little Italy. And when you've got a name like Duffy and you live in Little Italy, you know, you've got to come up swinging every morning, I'll tell you that. Because a lot of them little wop assholes want a piece of your ass every day, you know. And I'd hold my father's hand. And his hand was as big as my torso, you know. And we'd walk through Little Italy. And my father never wore a coat. He always wore a vest. And he wore striped shirts with them button-on collars, but he never wore the collar. And he used to have black, fuzzy hair used to come out here. It was like steel wool. I can remember sometimes when he'd hold me close to it, it would itch. And he wore a derby. And he knew everybody. He didn't laugh and he didn't talk. He roared. You could hear him from blocks away. And he knew everybody. We'd go past the produce store and the guy would give him a bag of apples. Somebody would give him two loaves of Italian bread. The butcher would give him a fish to take home. Everybody was always giving my father things, you know. And he was always lending money and doing things like that. What I remember is holding the hand. I'd look at these little Italian kids, you know, and I knew they wanted me bad. But I knew as long as I held that hand, nothing could happen to me. I knew that. And so I held tight. And my father knew everything. He knew why the grass was green, why the stars came out. Anything I asked him, he had the answer to. I fully realize now that it was probably all bullshit. But you wouldn't deny a little kid his dreams. You know. And you know, that's how I feel now. I'm probably the luckiest guy or luckiest person in AA. I get to be with my father at least twice every day. Every day. My father's been dead since 1951. But there's not a day goes by that I'm not blessed with his presence. I sat with him this morning, you know, watching it get daylight on the side of the bed. And about 5 after 5, you know, telling him about how beautiful this is. And I'll say goodnight to him tonight someplace, long way from you. When you retire tonight and I retire tonight, I'll be driving up a very shaded lane called the Silverado Trail, right into the heart of the wine country of Northern California. If you want to know where it is, watch Falcon Crest. That's where I live. And I'll be thinking of my dad, and I'll turn into that driveway, and I have 2 dogs that'll meet me, and a wife that I love, whom I'm emotionally involved with. That's, you got the message right. I always tell people who say, don't get emotionally involved, as you better tell my wife that. And again, I'll talk to my father. And I'll talk to him about how happy I am being sober. And how happy I was being in a place called Idaho. And then I'll just probably say a prayer for all of you who I don't know. And I sort of hope, you know, sometimes that maybe you'll say a little prayer for me tonight. Because the power of prayer is the essence of this program. Please accept this from me. I can almost prove to any of you in this room right now not only the existence of a God of your choice and understanding, but if you have the courage to face a challenge, I believe I can prove to you the power of God. And I'll ask you to do one rather simple thing. To find that proof. Whether you believe or you don't believe, I challenge you tonight to get off by yourself wherever it's going to be when your day ends. to approach the possibility of prayer. And if you're ashamed of this obvious sign of weakness, you could wait until you get off by yourself someplace. Or if you're forced to share a room, you can do the same thing we do in prison. You can pull the blanket up over your head, and that way they'll think you're masturbating instead of praying. And you don't even have to go like that. And you don't have to get down on your knees either if you don't want. Hell, you can smoke if you have. And I ask you to lay there and call upon a God of your understanding. And I would pray that in your life someplace, there is someone like in my life, in my Father. And as I would talk to my Father, I would hope you would talk to your God. And just for tonight, say this. God, make tomorrow a better day for. And then you put the name of anybody you want in there. Preferably somebody whom you're going to be able to be in contact with tomorrow. In other words, you say, God, make tomorrow a better day for Jim. And then forget it. Put out your cigarette, close your eyes, and go to sleep. When you get up tomorrow morning, which will be Monday morning, don't you tell anybody who you prayed for tonight. You keep that between you and God. And then I challenge you to watch what happens tomorrow in the life of the person whom you pray for tonight. Challenge you. As evidence of the validity of that prayer, are any of us so sick in this room right now that we cannot deny or do deny that it's quite possible that we all sit here this very moment with some semblance of dignity back in our lives as a result of the direct prayers of someone else? Thank you very much.